This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode 94, was recorded on February 24th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. Jeff Snyder is back, and it wouldn't be Jeff Snyder without the slide deck, so be sure to download the slide deck that accompanies today's episode. You'll find the download link in the description of today's episode on our homepage at macrovoices.com. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Jeff Snyder, CIO at Alhambra Investments. It finally seems as if all the talk of a global economic rebound is maybe starting to die down. We started this year with sentiment pretty solidly optimistic, but that's been derailed. The question is why? Now, obviously, a lot of people, including myself, have their eye on China and the coronavirus pandemic, which I guess the WHO announced today is not a pandemic, according to them. I personally disagree. And that's what you hear every time some negative piece of news comes out. Now, Jeff, you think it's more important to figure out why these negative signs have reemerged than it is to argue about the probability of a recession. Some might ask, does the why really make a difference? I mean, if a recession happens, does it really matter what caused it?
Well, Eric, you know, in past business cycles, you never really cared about what caused the recession. You know, one would just show up, it would get bad, and then recovering back to normal in pretty short period of time. You know, a business cycle was just a business cycle, almost as if they were interchangeable or completely flat and devoid of any kind of nuance. But we aren't anywhere near a business cycle. And the key reason why is this lack of growth. So in other words, our focus shouldn't just be on the potential downside, which we seem to be looking at right now. It should be more on, you know, why has there been such a lack of upside beforehand? You know, what's the reason for this malaise, which has actually transcended the very idea of a business cycle? So in the same way that, you know, the doctors over there in Asia want to know the specific cause of the disease in order to prepare an effective treatment for it, we want to know what's really wrong with the economy. And if we get that wrong, yet again, the sickness, the economic sickness will only continue. Look, you know, like ninja loans in 2007 or profligate Southern Europeans in 2011 and oil supply glut in 2014 and trade wars in 2018, you know, the pandemic in 2020 is going to be a very easy scapegoat. When Jay Powell starts the Fed's next series of rate cuts, as the markets are really pricing in right now, all he'll have to say is, well, you know, the economy was in great shape and it was getting better. And then this disease outbreak hit the globe, which no one could have foreseen.
Well, Jeff, it's very, very interesting that you bring that up, because the way I've seen this situation is I feel like markets have been, at least until today, completely ignoring what I see as a very serious pandemic risk. But it seems like despite the evidence that a pandemic is coming, you know, markets keep trading to all-time highs until the last day or two. So let's start with your assessment of where we stand right now. Clearly, over the last few days and weeks, a lot of economic numbers have turned ugly. Now, for those who don't watch them as closely as you do, including myself, it might seem as if it was pandemic related, although that really hadn't affected the markets initially. So how do you see this? What's causing the numbers to turn down?
Well, for one, you know, on Friday, IHS Market reported what was a pretty shocking deterioration in its PI estimate for the whole U.S. economy. The composite index fell all the way down to 49.6, below that magical 50 line for February 2020, and it was 53.3 in January. You see these on, you know, starting on slide 3, 4, and 5. Now, that number below 50 has been consistent with zero GDP growth, or what in the past few times have been very near recessions. So that's what markets numbers are already suggesting, where we are in the middle of the first quarter of 2020.
Okay, so what you're suggesting is that it's not just the coronavirus pandemic that's to blame here.
Yeah, just like it wasn't trade wars that started this downturn, there's something else going on. Even when, you know, these various outlets report these figures and they point to the scapegoat flavor of the month, whether it's, you know, trade wars before, they'd always note that, hey, global growth isn't good either. The downturn didn't start or turn lower once the coronavirus hit the news at the outset of 2020. This has been coming for some time now. It's been building for actually a couple of years. You know, it's another way in which the global economy doesn't really conform to the traditional business cycle conventions. You know, Eric, as you and I talked about the last time I was here, there were a lot of warning signs about the state of the economy and quite a few leading indicators, as you see on slide 6, that had already suggested it wasn't actually getting better long before we got to this year. And those were, you know, not only before we got to this year, but long before the coronavirus and long before all of the stuff with trade deals and trade wars. So, you know, there's been a rush of so-called hard data that showed a significant deterioration in economic conditions all during last year's fourth quarter, which is well before anyone had heard about the outbreak in China. You know, you look at what's been going on in Japan, what's being reported out of Japan, and more importantly, what's being reported economically out of Europe.
Well, the recent data from Europe isn't good. I know that much.
Yeah, not only are the numbers pretty alarming, they're all for the fourth quarter. Before the U.S. PMI plunged in February, the European economy took a major hit in the fourth quarter. Start with Germany, slide 7, which is Europe's biggest constituent economy. The German economy managed to avoid a technical recession with the smallest possible, I mean, tiniest possible positive GDP figure. But that masks the extent of the stress that's going on there. You know, GDP in the fourth quarter was positive over the third quarter, but it was still less than it was in the first quarter of 2019. So in other words, there was no growth in Germany for the final three quarters of last year. And on top of that, as you can see on the chart I'm showing you here, industrial production absolutely plunged in December. Again, that was before any knowledge of the virus in China. Industry has been at the forefront of this downturn, and it's very plain and obvious when all that began. The declines in industrial production, like GDP, started all the way back in the first few months of 2018. It's as if someone had flipped a switch right where I've marked it on the chart. It doesn't look like a recession because it isn't really one. It's been a slow downturn, like this economy is being squeezed by some unrelenting force. You know, it gets a little bit worse, taking a little bit more off of growth for now 2 years, and only now 2 years later is this downturn starting to look like a traditional recession.
What about the rest of Europe?
Well, you can go through them one by one. If you go to slide 8, in Europe's second largest economy, France, GDP did turn negative in the fourth quarter. And like in Germany, industrial production in France tanked. The French economy had actually been somewhat more stable than the German economy. But as you can see, something substantially changed all the way back at the start of 2018. Go to slide 9. After France comes Italy, which is Europe's third largest. Same thing as the other two. The underlying economic condition changed way back in the earliest months of 2018. And by the fourth quarter of 2019, 2 years later, it finally blatantly accelerated to the downside. Q4 of last year was Italy's worst quarter in years. And it was propelled by the same industrial downturn. And so the U.S. economy has simply been following Europe's, its own slowdown, which, you know, which has already led to 3 Fed rate cuts so far this year. That began a few months after Europe's in 2018, which is just what all the U.S. dollar curves had been indicating all along.
Okay, so even before Italy became the first Western country to have a coronavirus outbreak, their economy was in serious trouble to start with before they got hit with the virus. Now, you've pointed out these bond and money curves the last time that you were on the show. Actually, I think you included them in your slides almost every time that we've had you on.
Yeah, it's because they're hard to ignore. If you go to slides 10 and 11, they give you so much information about the state of the monetary system, you know, economic risks and everything like that. You almost have to marvel at how central bankers, especially at the Fed, do so much to ignore them. You know, they dismiss these beneficial signals, especially when they're contrary to, you know, Jay Powell or whatever Fed chairman's position, as they so often are. And, you know, that's just what the bond market and the Eurodollar futures have been doing the last 4 or 5 months. Powell and other policymakers have been saying the economy's on the rebound. Well, the curves have been saying, no way, it's not happening.
Okay, I've learned, Jeff, not to say that that's dollar bullish, because I know you hate to associate the term bullish with this kind of situation. But that is dollar positive in the sense that the result of that should be the dollar appreciating against other currencies, correct?
Yeah, from the human perspective, there's absolutely nothing bullish about a rising dollar or king dollar, whatever you want to call it. The dollar is the thing. If you go to slide 12, it is the global disinflationary pressures that certain central bankers and policymakers have finally caught on to. When the dollar goes up, bad things happen everywhere. When it was falling like it was in 2017, they called it globally synchronized growth, and there was nobody to stop them because that's what it looked like. Then it stopped falling when early on in 2018, if you see on slide 13, it was like that's the switch that was flipped for the global economy. And it has been a globally synchronized downturn ever since, 2 years. It predated the trade wars, and it far predated the coronavirus. So along with the idea of an economic rebound to end last year, you heard practically everyone turn negative on the dollar too. You know, if Powell was right about the economy, then a falling dollar like 2017 would have been the result. Only as usual, there was little indication, especially in the bond and money markets, that he was right. And I'm not just talking about the repo market either. You know, it's what's really going on in the monetary shadows that matter. That given enough time, they do show up and they push the dollar higher when they do. And that's what we've seen so far in 2020. The same global dollar shortage that never really went away at the end of last year. These disinflationary pressures, which are creating these global economic headwinds, seem to have now intensified and even gone, you know, even before we got to the end of last year. So unsurprisingly, then, the dollar is on fire again, even though its, you know, its prior rally was declared dead and gone last October. Because nothing really had changed for the shadow money fundamentals of the dollar, therefore the trend wasn't really broken.
Okay, let's be precise here. When you say the shadow money fundamentals of the dollar, you mean the shadow euro-dollar monetary mechanics, which we describe in great detail in Eurodollar University, which is on the Macro Voices website at macrovoices.com/edu. You're saying that the reasons why the dollar behaves why it does is because of this shadow euro-dollar system. Now, you often point out that it's good how people are starting to catch on that when the dollar goes up, it's a bad thing, not a good thing. But more important than that, the next crucial step, in your view, is to understand why it goes up in the first place. So please help us understand that.
Yeah, I've shown you the dollar against the euro so far, but it's a universal thing. This euro-dollar system is, after all, the global reserve system, the currency reserve system. So that's how all of these economic downturns get synchronized. Not exactly, but you know, they're not exactly synchronized, but enough such that once, you know, some negative pressures in the euro-dollar system get going, you know, given enough time, nobody is immune from them. So if we go to slide 14 and turn from the euro to, say, you know, something like the Brazilian real, we find a pretty similar track record over the same period in question. The last 2 years of rising misfortune alongside the rising dollar exchange value. Again, absolutely nothing bullish about it. And there's a lot that's interesting and important about the Brazilian currency as it relates to what called these disinflationary pressures, why the dollar goes up when it does. When it first showed up in early 2018, as usual, it was ignored. But then in April and May of 2018, the dollar screamed higher and put most of the emerging market world into a tailspin. In Brazil, the central bank responded because it had to. It couldn't just sit there and watch the real plummet again like the currency had just a few years ago during what I call Eurodollar number three. So in this fourth one, this Eurodollar number four, as you can see on slide 15, Banco officials did the usual TV interviews expressing confidence that they had the situation under control, and that if they wanted to, they could support the real with no problem at all. And then they tried. In slide 16, you can see they deployed what are called or were described as currency swaps, but in reality are rate swaps. So basically, Banco plays around with the difference or spread between the onshore real money rate and future dollar deliveries. It's called the cupom cambial. You know, what Brazil's central bank really is doing is attempting to influence the dollar behavior of the banks in its orbit, both domestic and foreign.
And that's the part that we're really interested in here, because I want to put all this Brazilian stuff in perspective. I'm assuming that you're setting up this example using these arcane Brazilian monetary procedures in order to illustrate what might really be going on in the global euro-dollar system as it pertains to shadow dollar conditions. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's just what the cupom cambial describes. When dollars are harder to source and obtain on global offshore markets, this euro-dollar system, Eric, you and I talk about all the time, that is dollar price positive, just like a short squeeze, which for Brazil means a falling real. Now, the central bank responds with these rate swaps, which have the effect of subsidizing banks who want to import dollars into Brazil with the theory that that stabilizes the currency. In other words, what we notice is that by the falling currency and the official reaction to it, which are these swaps, it tells us that it must be getting expensive for banks in Brazil to fund their dollar requirements, which are always substantial. That's the whole business of a reserve currency. Now, what we can make of that is one of two things. Either something has changed for Brazil alone, meaning that banks are offering euro dollars, are making them more expensive only in Brazil because they don't like what's going on specifically in Brazil. The other option is that, you know, these euro-dollar banks are making dollar funding more expensive because there's a problem with the euro-dollar banks in the euro-dollar system. And it's not really hard to figure out which one it is. if the falling real is an isolated case of trouble observable only in Brazil, then it's obviously the first option. But if Brazil is hardly alone in its struggle, which is pretty much what we can observe globally over the past couple of years, it must be a systemic dollar problem that is causing euro dollars to become more expensive for everyone. In other words, a global dollar shortage. And that's the rising dollar, which wrecks everything if you let it, which since officials have no idea what's actually going on in the monetary system, they do. You know, QEs or not QEs, they do little or nothing to help the situation.
Okay, Jeff, but if central bankers are not really in tune with what's really going on with the dollar, if they don't understand this euro-dollar mechanism, why it's rising in any period and so forth, well, I would think then that you probably don't want to make too much of their economic forecast, because if you don't understand the mechanism, you can't very well forecast the future, can you?
Yeah, and then that's the other part of Brazil's experience that's worth spending some time on. What you can see in the IMF figures that I'm showing you on the slides is that it looks like Brazilian central bankers bought into the mainstream narrative of an economic rebound. And I mean that literally. After having rolled over their rate swaps, you know, this Cupom Cambial dollar subsidy, going back to last September, they started to unwind them and pay them off. You know, why would they do that? And it was almost certainly because Jay Powell said so. He didn't come out and say it like that, but you know, with the repo operations, with not QE, with Europe's QE, and then all the proclamations about how these were definitely working and turning the world around, you know, Richard Caraita's, you know, abating disinflationary pressures, I showed it at the first slide. You know, why wouldn't Brazil's central bank wind down their Cupom operations? They thought that whatever their dollar problems might have been, they were all done, like Powell said. And you know, and almost as soon as they did, the real tanked again. Last November, when everything was purported going so well, Banco had to intervene directly in currency markets again, and they did it again just a couple of weeks ago. So, you also noticed that they've stopped withdrawing their swaps. So, you know, Brazil's experience over the last 6 months pretty much, you know, it confirms our story. The dollar problem did not go away as advertised, and the situation in the first couple of months of 2020 has grown worse all over again. Same dollar shortage, same disinflationary pressures, only now they're intensifying, not abating.
So while some of the more recent dollar issues could be attributed to fears associated with the coronavirus impact, you're saying that there's a lot more to the picture than that, that this pre-existing dollar condition that left the global economy in rough shape existed even before we headed into the pandemic crisis, which I'm convinced is upon us now. And that's just another headwind, to use the official term, on top of severe and sustained dollar pressures that have intensified all on their own. This matters, and I think it matters a lot, because it's not just a short-term issue of recession that you're talking about, right? I mean, there's a bigger picture to consider here.
Yeah, and that's why we want to get down to the actual cause of the economic problem. The world isn't suffering from the prospect of recession. It's suffering from the fact that we've never recovered from the last one. So in other words, yes, you know, the downside in 2020 is an important issue, and so is the virus, you know, how that might impact it. But far more important to me is the lack of upside the last 12 years. You know, what happened to growth? This hasn't been a recovery. And the key reason why is nobody seems able to explain why economic growth changed right around 2008. The global economy just hasn't been the same since. And every time it seems like it is ready to really recover, like 2017 or 2014, something short circuits the process and it stops it right in its tracks. And each time this happens, we're told the wrong thing. In 2008, it was supposedly subprime mortgages. In 2011, it was Portuguese and Greek debt. In 2015, somehow too much oil that crashed its price and depressed global investment. In 2018, they said it was all trade wars. And now it's, you know, obviously it's going to be China's virus problem. So while all those things did happen, they were not the overriding issue. The dysfunctional eurodollar system was, which is why you see the dollar go up in each of these episodes, more so since 2014. Meanwhile, you know, it's amazing to me that our current president is fighting with his immediate predecessor over who's responsible for this amazing growth. It's not growth. There's been no upside at all. If you look at the last slides of the presentation, 17 to 22.
Okay, Jeff, but if they call it amazing growth, then knowing that they won't be challenged, it becomes a political game where neither of them can be blamed. Either Obama created the conditions for this boom or Trump did.
Yeah, and by all the evidence, there is no boom. And that's, you know, that's why I'm ending the presentation with slides 17 through 22. You know, there is no boom. The dollar shortage has continually depressed growth everywhere, not just in the United States. And that's one reason why the bond market is linked. You know, why are treasury yields behaving the same way as German bonds? If we allow the current downturn to be put down as trade wars or coronavirus, then this will just continue. instead of a real recovery and a real boom after this fourth Eurodollar problem, you know, when it inevitably does finish up, probably sometime this year, there will be nothing better than another reflation cycle following it, a reflation number four, which will be way overhyped like it was in 2017 and 2014, only to be inevitably followed by a fifth Eurodollar problem down the road. And that's what's really important about identifying these issues behind this current downturn. Maybe people didn't care about what caused recessions in the past, but this is very different. We have to break this Eurodollar cycle in order to get back into a real business cycle. And it starts with understanding these dollar dynamics, not just that when the dollar goes up, it's bad for everyone. More important, why it goes up. Only then maybe can we stop its destructive behavior and from erasing even more upside than it already has.
Okay, Jeff, I wanted to start with your slide deck and walking through it as we just have to get your perspective and make sure it's clear to our listeners that you see, even before the virus pandemic ever came up, that the economy had a real problem and also that the U.S. dollar was appreciating independent and that upward pressure on the dollar relative to other currencies had occurred independent of the virus or before the virus ever came up. I want to move on now and incorporate some of my own research and perspectives with what you're seeing, because I think that we are headed into a global coronavirus pandemic. I think that what China has been through, I'm hoping the rest of the world won't go through something quite that bad, because we'll learn a few lessons from China's experience. We'll be a little better prepared for it, but we're still going to go through it. And we're already seeing outbreaks in Italy and South Korea, and I fear that it's just the beginning. So I want to talk about, as the coronavirus situation occurs, there's two aspects of it that I want to talk to you about. The first one is the U.S. dollar impact. Coronavirus, I think, by itself would be very dollar positive in the sense that it would cause a lot of flight capital to move into dollars and U.S. treasuries. When you have these other forces that you've already described working, do they compound each other or do they offset each other? In other words, if there's dollar pressure, upside dollar pressure coming from the coronavirus, does that exacerbate the feedback loops that exist in the Eurodollar system that you study, or does it mitigate it slightly?
No, it can become self-reinforcing. And that's really, you know, when you get into the true downside cases, that's where it really becomes really negative, is when you have existing dollar pressures, which are, you know, put it into some very simple terms like we see today, risk off. And risk off means as much to inside the Eurodollar system as it does on the stock market. Banks are not going to be willing to fund other people's dollar activities to the same level and the same reasonable efficiency as they have in the past if they perceive that the coronavirus is going to have a much bigger impact, which it might. And Eric, you probably know a hell of a lot more about the virus than I do. So, you know, to answer your question, it does, it becomes self-reinforcing to the point where it's risk off that leads to more risk off that leads to more risk off. And that's, you know, positive for the U.S. dollar. It's also positive for treasuries and falling yields and that type of thing, too.
I have been studying the coronavirus situation very carefully, and there's an aspect of this that I want to tie in to your work in the Eurodollar, which is the prognosis, in my mind, is very, very different for developed nations versus the developing world. And the reason is what George Soros called reflexivity. And the scenario is as follows. The coronavirus, fortunately, has a fairly low case fatality rate if you can provide quality medical care. So in a country like the United States or most of Western Europe, where there's good medical care, what we can expect is a whole lot of people are going to get infected with this thing. They're going to be treated. A lot of them are going to get pneumonia, but it is a curable viral pneumonia, which will have a fairly high hospitalization rate. About 15% of the people who get the COVID coronavirus are going to require hospitalization, but it's a curable pneumonia, which can be treated with hospitalization. That works in the developed world, but in developing countries, let's take India, for example, they've got so many people and they don't have anything close to adequate medical facilities. What is going to happen, unfortunately, I think, is the case fatality rate will be much, much higher in less developed countries that don't have as elaborate of a medical system. Because if you've got someone who has a curable viral pneumonia, it might be curable if you had the right medical system. But if millions of people have it and the medical system is overwhelmed, then people are going to be dying. And you see a really big difference with this virus. What we've seen so far is case fatality rates around 1 to 3% if you can treat it. when you get into a situation like Wuhan had, they at one point were looking at about an 18% fatality rate because the medical facilities had become overwhelmed and they couldn't treat it. So I think developing, you know, EM and DM are going to have very different experiences with the virus. Now, of course, I could be wrong in my analysis, but let's pretend for sake of discussion that what I just described turns out to be true about the way this virus plays out differently in emerging markets versus developed. What does that say to you in terms of how it relates to your work with the Eurodollar?
Well, it's just like I said, I think it becomes self-reinforcing because look, the dollar system, the banks that operate in the euro dollar system are already viewing emerging markets negatively. There's already a pre-existing view of, hey, there's too much risk, not enough upside in the EM worlds as it is. So throw in, you know, what you're talking about, Eric, which would be a much higher problem or much higher fallout, maybe that's the right way to say it, from the coronavirus in those places. It becomes even more, you know, it's another risk on top of pre-existing risk, and it might even be the primary risk going forward. But it's going to create more havoc, more financial havoc for these places because, you know, they're not going to be able to fund their dollar activities, their economic activities, the way that they need to. And so, you know, the downside case is where these things, these risks combine and become self-reinforcing. And in the situation as you describe it, you can see how that might easily happen.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back on next month for another update. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend-following strategies, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.